I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello, welcome to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders podcast. My name is Brady Huggett, and I'm the host. Who's the guest? Today's guest is Daniel Cohen. So who's Daniel? Daniel is the CEO and chairman of Pharnext, and he was also a leader in the industrialization of genomic sequencing. I think that's probably the best way to describe it. He was a co-founder at Millennium Pharmaceuticals. He was a co-founder at Ceph. He's a former chief scientific officer at Genset, which is a European flagship biotech company, genomics-based drug development. We talked about all that in this conversation. We also discussed Daniel's love for music. I think he would consider that still his first and maybe true love. We talked about his outlook on life, and that when you're seeking answers, you must always put an "and" after what you feel is the answer. I mean, that's the way you keep your mind curious and you keep seeking the truth. Great conversation. Passionate guy. I loved having him in the studio. So here it is, your First Rounders podcast with Daniel Cohen. Listen up.
On the mic as we can. So you don't have to, but if you want to get it up close to you and just sort of talk naturally, let's see. That should be pretty good. Looks like that's pretty good. I mean, we could probably start at the beginning, right? I knew you were born in Tunisia, right?
That's right.
So how did that happen?
But it was my father and my mother. Uh-huh. They married together and I was born there. And I must say that this is something really important to me because this is probably where I got this taste for things that are not complicated, but complex. I mean, the difference between complicated and complex. It was complex because the society was very heterogeneous, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, living all together in a very, very elegant and pacific way and with a lot of understanding. But I understood to see things with different angles. I look at polymorphism.
Yeah,
from the beginning,
right?
Like this, and multicultural, that has been a lot of a lot influential my way of thinking today.
But so did you were born there? Did you grow up?
I was born there, and I switched to French when I was 9.
Oh, okay.
And then I studied there in France.
So 9 years. Did your family move to?
Yes, the whole family moved.
Okay. And can you tell me, you mentioned your parents, they met there in Tunisia?
Yes, they were born there.
They both were, yeah. And then, so their whole family.
So the whole family, because there was some sort of war there. So we are migrants, and we migrate just before the problem started, the political issue started, and we migrate in Marseille. And then I spent there. I started to study primary school, then music at the same time, and then we switched to Paris when I was 15, continuing both music and.
Just you, your family moved to Paris.
Yeah, my whole family.
Right? Oh, to Paris, right.
Yes, to Paris.
So, yeah, I know, I saw that you had, and I think probably still do have, a great affinity for music.
I consider myself more than a musician than a scientist. And that's probably an influence also on my way to conceive science. I am now a conductor of symphonic orchestra. I mean, again, polymorphism, complexity. Put mixing sex together, cocktails, belongs to my way of life, too. Okay.
So you conduct music now, you're saying?
Yeah.
All right, we have to get to this. So when you started school, were your interests first for music, Or did it happen at the same time?
Yes, when I was six, maybe five, I was interested in music. And I grew up with very little means. We were rather poor in Tunisia. No piano. I was fascinated by piano. And when you get in France, I could get a piano. And then I started to study piano, solfège, composition, harmony, and so on. And then I wanted to be a professional pianist first, before 18. So I was professional for 1 or 2 years.
You were?
Yeah, sort of, okay.
What does that mean, though?
I mean, I played public concerts. And people, a little bit of money.
Right, so that makes you professional, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit, just to start. And suddenly I realized that I started too late. I started really 11 years old, just when I got the piano. For me, it was too late, so I said, okay, better. I continue music all my life, and I studied to study medicine. I choose to study medicine because I believe that when studying medicine, I will have time to continue music. And it was a big mistake, because when you start medicine,
you're in it, yeah.
So I was doing less music, but I studied, I was intern, so I studied both medicine. Then I was highly attracted by science, and basically because I didn't want to spend my life to sign a death certificate, because the way I look at medicine is that a lot of people die of it, no cure. So I said, okay, I can't stay like this. So I decided to move to science. Actually, I met my boss.
Well, let me back you up. So you're saying, first off, back to the music. You said that you realized you started too late, meaning that you...
I mean, technically, you know, it's like sport. If you have to get muscles.
Don't? Yeah.
Okay. If you start too late, in my opinion, your muscles are not enough developed to have a technique that allows you to do what you want.
So you said around 11 you started the music. So that you should have started at 5 or something.
My son, I have a son that is pure genius. Is he my son?
That's right.
I'm a Jewish father too, by the way. So he started at 3. And now he's also 11, but he really wants to become professional. And he will do it because he has studied probably.
Yeah.
So that was the problem. But I kept the passion for music, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So when I studied medicine, I stopped it a little bit. Not stop. I did not want to do that deeply. And after my internship, I realized that my muscle melted. So I decided to go to learn how to conduct orchestra. And then I went back to conservatorium when I was 30 to study conducting.
I see. So you sort of stopped practicing to be a pianist and then to conduct instead.
Because it was easier technically.
Okay.
Although it was a big mistake also, because the technology does not come from your muscle but from your brain.
Yeah.
Because the conductor is the most difficult part of music. You have to learn everything. You have to play like all instruments. You have to understand everything, the score there. So now this is what I'm doing part-time. And I can conduct. I've been conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
In London.
Yeah, in London, right?
Yeah, I loved it. And many orchestras.
You mean all the time? Or you're a guest conductor?
No, well, guest conductor once a year.
Oh, great.
I am begging to...
to do more.
And I play, you know, I'm just a poor geneticist. Please allow me to... just allow me to conduct. And
once, yeah. Okay, so, I'm sorry. So then you switched to medicine, and you said... This was to be a physician.
Absolutely. I wanted to be a physician because it has to me that it was attractive because I could be like Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes trying to solve an enigma.
Solve an enigma,
Diagnose. Yeah.
Yep.
And then I did my internship. I saw patients and I realized that you can solve enigma but no solution, especially in neurology. I was interested. It's like botanic. You look at patients, measure this, but I have nothing to propose to them. But it was really hard. So I switched to research, and I was lucky that at the second floor of my building, when I had the clinics, the second floor was Jean Dossier.
Oh, that's how you met him.
Yeah.
I wondered. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Very simple. Second floor, and we met, and in the first few seconds, we fall in love together, to be frank. He was 70, I was 35, half. And, you know, this guy told me, you're an intern. Oh, He likes intern
people. Yeah.
You are intern. Come here, you will enjoy. So we started to work. At that time, it was 1978, something like that. Uh-huh. And there was no DNA, really almost nothing. And he was working on a very interesting concept. You know, he discovered HLA, that is histocompatibility things. He got the Nobel Prize for that 2 years later.
Right, in 80 or something, right?
Yeah. Yes. And we were looking at association, genetic association between HLA and disease. This single locus, few megabase, has alleles associated with many different diseases. So it was really interesting at that time. And when I joined him, we decided to go into the DNA of HLA. It was the real beginning of things. And I was trained, therefore, in immunology because of HLA, in genetics because of the background of HLA is pure genetics, uh-huh. really hard genetics, true genetics, I would say. And at the same time, in try to integrate new technology of DNA. So I was close to Southern, the guy that described the Southern blood.
Right, yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. So we did the first polymorphism on the first SNPs, if you want.
Yeah.
Already with restriction enzyme, refills at that time, on HLA, published it. It has been very interesting. And at that time, Jean Dossier, when he got the Nobel Prize, received a legacy of something like $10 million. And he told me, what do we do with this?
You're in his lab?
Yeah.
Right? So your MD is finished. You're doing a PhD postdoc?
Yeah. Postdoc.
In his lab?
In his lab.
Okay, because he was the floor above you, invited you up, and you said, I'm working for his lab. Okay. And then he gets a Nobel Prize.
Again, with the Nobel Prize, he got the legacy of a woman, $10 million.
Yeah.
So what do we do with this?
Right.
And he said, whether we place it and live with the interest or something else. What do you think? I said, better we burn it. We burn it, put the whole thing on one thing.
Uh-huh.
The early being, let's put that on a genome story. And we'll burn it. If it works, we get even more money.
Right? Yeah.
And this is what he gave me the money. Take it. He was still with me every day. So he decided to recreate a big lab in his office because we had no space. So he gave me his office, maybe 50 square meters. Made a lab to start a genome. Basically.
This is CEF, right? This is the Center for Human Polymorphisms?
Yeah. And we shared an office of 10 square meters together.
One desk.
Yeah. When you receive someone, I get out and vice versa. And then, like this, the CEF story started. We proposed the concept. We meet with Ray White, blah, blah, blah. And little by little, we can convince that we should solve a technical problem. Is that if we go to map the genome or to sequence the genome by hand, it will never work.
So yeah.
I was very lucky to meet with François Mitterrand at that time, was the president of France, that opened me many doors to get a financing. You see?
How did you meet him?
I met him because I needed money. I need more money.
Yeah. Right? The $10 million wasn't enough to run this company, right?
And I wrote to him, not to him. I said, I need to meet Mitterrand because this guy will help me.
The president of France. He just thought he's going to help me.
And Anthony, there is a guy there you should talk with, Jacques Attali, very famous now. He was the advisor of Mitterrand. And I wrote to him, I am working on this story, Jean. I need some help. He said, okay, make me a note. I made a note of one page. Okay, can you see me?
What was the note?
And I'm not saying, okay, there is a possibility for us to create a specialized lab that will be a big lab to automate the biological experiment,
uh-huh.
to make it automatic instead by hand. That will create a genome and explain what the genome is. And that we can make a lot of things in medicine and science. Blah, blah, blah.
But so did he must have thought, I mean, he's the president of France, right? So he must have thought this is going to help the country overall.
Yeah.
This happens in France.
Absolutely. He was first fascinated by the idea. So he told me, okay, come, Mitterrand, and explain to me. So I went there, We had no PowerPoint. With transparent. I don't know if you remember that. You don't remember.
Right. Yeah.
With transparent, I prepared explaining the genome, the difference between mouse, monkeys. He was fascinated that we share the same thing with monkeys, actually, and mouse.
Yep.
I said, this is great. I love it. Blah blah blah. And it was just before his second election, so. For his second election, he wrote a letter that was published in the journal Le Monde, where he called the Speech to the French, where he spoke, well, I will do this. And one of the chapters was on the human genome, saying it's more important than to go to the moon. And since that period, he helped me financially, not him, but opened me many doors, and I get a lot of financing, more,
and,
even more.
And he was elected, you're also
He was elected. Yeah, he came, we make a new lab. He came, I inaugurate the lab. And then, second miracle after him, I met another guy, great person, Bernard Barato, had the son that died from muscular dystrophy, Duchenne.
Yep.
And this guy was a genius too, absolute genius. And he said, you know, we are doing things manually when we could now automatize everything. I never found anyone that is interested by just automation. He was engineer by background. So I showed him.
He was. Things. He was an engineer, yeah.
Okay. How much do you need to make this map? I said, 100 million. Take the check. Make the story short. And I got it. And he had even bigger lab called Geneton 4 months later.
I see. Okay.
Quite installed with a lot of robots have created, blah, blah, blah. And with this, we made the first map of the human genome, me and other colleagues that I invited. So it was a fascinating period, really.
So that, but this lab was basically funded by one person, sort of. I mean, he...
Not him. This association, excuse me, I was not clear. He was the chairman of the French Muscular Dystrophy Association.
Ah, okay.
And the lab we created... The idea came from him, Geneton,
yep.
Like my Teleton, uh-huh. Because the money they get was coming from French Teleton. And the French Teleton was doing, is still doing, about $100 million a year. So it could be part of that. And for many years, we have been financed in this new facility. That was a huge facility. I can tell you, it was many hundreds of square meters, 1,000 square meters, with a lot of robots. It was really modern. We introduced, for example, stupid things like barcodes on tubes. It was never done before. Can you imagine at that time?
No, what on tubes?
Yeah, it's very simple. Now it's obvious. But you have, when you have to manipulate many tubes,
yeah.
not to mix up, you have to put barcodes.
It was barcodes,
very new at that time. It was everything was extremely new. Okay? So it does, and I remember a video of whole robots assembled in one single room. And I showed that to Jim Watson in Colfin Harbor and other colleagues, and they were really under shock, I would say. Me too, actually, to be frank. And we became famous, not because of the map first. We became because of the facility. People said, wow, this guy thinks big.
Yeah, yeah.
Unusual
yeah.
to see that out from France. And they all came.
Who?
Bill at the time, Craig Venture. Eric Lander was my pupil there. I came to spend many, many months, if I remember. Mark Levin.
All right. So they came to your lab to basically see how you're doing
these magic things. Yeah. How we do large scale biology. At that time, it was brand new.
I think I'm trying to remember. So you guys, Geneton said that you had the first physical map.
Yeah.
In 1993, yes. I think, right?
Yeah.
And you're saying, like, Venter came and visited, Lander came and visited.
All of them.
And then, you know, Venter
Collins,
went home.
Francis
Collins, right.
Jim Watson came, made a show on the TV. Yep. No, everyone came.
But Venter went back and automated his own research, right?
I'm sure. He recognized it very well. It has been inspiring for the whole industry and all field, not only industry, that if you wanted to make the genome, we have to put a lot of robots together. That's been the first story. It has been very stimulating, and all these companies, Insight and so on, were created from that. The company of Craig Venture, Cetera, and so on. That's been the replication.
Yeah.
And sometimes even in larger format, but exactly the same principle. Were created. And therefore, I think this was the premium for large-scale biology and big data also, because when we produce the map, we cannot see the map on papers. We have to put that on computers. Only can to interpret a lot of data with wrong things together, like it is today, big data. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was not that big at that. And I remember that we have to share that on the internet. And when we announced the map, we had to explain to the people what the internet was. Nobody was
where to find it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to find and what the internet, even the large public, I mean, not the specialized, not the scientists. So it was all story that was really fascinating at that time. So, and frankly, very, very, very quickly, I get bored.
You did. Well, hold on. So but explain to me, you know, the difference between the physical map, you know, the physical map of the genome versus the
sequence.
Yeah, the sequencing.
The physical map is very, very primitive. It's just a sort of skeleton of the genome. If you want to sequence the genome, you cannot sequence piece of too large. At that time, you could sequence only pieces of 500 bases.
Yeah. At once, one by one.
So the idea was to chop the genome into smaller pieces and have it in the same order and then sub-chop it in even smaller until 500. So we started to chop the genome in pieces of one megabase or two, uh-huh, called YAX, yeast artificial chromosomes. And the story, it's good to cut the genome. It's like you put in scissors on a complex mixture of wire. Uh-huh. If you cut random, you don't know how the pieces are all ordered. So make the physical map was to reorder the pieces. That's all.
I see. Okay. Still
at that time it was a complicated thing, but not that complex. It was complicated. But okay, not that funny. And then we could also put polymorphic markers every whatever 2-5 megabases. That was a genetic map, uh-huh, useful to map disease genes. This was done with my colleague Jean Weissenbach there in the same mood. And these two sort of maps were the first backbone to make large-scale genomic study, like finding disease genes, basically. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then later on, other maps were produced, smaller chops, instead of one megabase was only maybe 50 kb, that could be sequenced easily. This has been the repetition of the story, but at larger scale, that has been done by Craig and others.
The government, yes, right, both. Okay. Okay, so then, but that's 1993, yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, so you'd been at Seth in the lab at the same time.
Seth Angeleton, that's only Seth Angeleton, and it was just that. But I was hooked, and that's where my interest to biotech came. Mark Levin, the founder of Millennium.
Yeah, and Lander, right? They're both founders.
No, I was the first founder, I think. And Lander came later.
Who?
Eric.
Oh, so you and Mark Levin first.
No, Mark Levin, and Raju Koshalapati.
Ah, okay.
And then, but I say after, so maybe a few days or a week later.
Right.
Came Jeff Friedman and Eric, and we formed a team to... to from Millennium with an idea that was genome is important to find targets.
All right. So at that point, you're suddenly thinking about drugs, right? I mean,
absolutely, exactly. Could we use our know-how in genomics to speed up the discovery of relevant drug targets, and therefore develop drug against this to improve medicine?
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but so then Lander comes to your, Mark Levin and Lander both, I guess, come to your lab and they think, all right, well, if we want to mine the genome for drugs, then we need this automated process and we want you on board to help us build this company.
Yes.
Yeah? No, okay.
Exactly, that.
Okay. And so did you move to the U.S.?
No, I was one day a week in Boston.
One day a week? You'd fly in?
I fly to Paris to Boston every week, something like this, for a year or two. And this is where I learned what is biotech, how you deal with investors, how you deal with farmers, blah, blah, blah. And I was really intrigued and interested because, in a way, it becomes very practical. You have to deliver.
You have to deliver.
You have to deliver for patients.
Deliver
to patients. And my background is a doctor. So I was really interested. But also at the same time, I was really bored by the genome story. Because it was really like monkey to repeat the same thing.
Yeah.
For years, I said, I will not do that all my life. Certainly not more than what I've done already, 3-4 years. And frankly, I was more interested to anticipate what we will do with the genomic information, when it will be available, than to generate it, because it was not too exciting to me. So this is what I did. In 96, I stopped Geneton. I quit.
Okay, so there's no more basic mining the genome then?
I mean, first of all, they were more interested in gene therapy than in something else. So I was not convinced it was the right approach. And I joined another company in France called Genset.
No, I remember Genset. Yeah,
that was
the European flagship, basically. Yeah.
Where we continue to develop the same, then this is what I wanted to do, to continue to anticipate what we'll do with genomic information to improve therapeutic. Probably not gene therapy and not cell therapy. I was more interested in drugs.
Let me stop. So you leave. Geneton is actually the lab of Seth, right?
They are paired together.
Yeah. Right. So you leave that. Do you leave Jean Dasset?
Absolutely.
Okay. How did that go? He'd been your mentor.
It has been a sad period because he didn't want me to leave to go to industry.
Yeah.
It was really,
he didn't believe in industry, or
he was a sort of left guy. You know, money is dirty. You know, and he did not. He never understood it until his death. That was
so. When you went to him and said, "I want,"
he said, "You. This is you are a traitor to our cause." Okay. But I knew from what this comes. He was not that bad guy. Just his
was he angry with you though?
He was angry with me. Yeah. He was until his death actually. Yeah. We talked very little since, because this is his culture. I do respect, and he was a sort of a romantic guy. Money is dirty, or industry is dirty. Okay, but that's fine. So I quit, and I quit academia. I resigned from my... I was a professor of genetics there in France. I resigned because I did not also appreciate too much the non-freedom you have in academia, to be frank, because you have to obey to the common ideas.
Yeah.
Anything you do has to be agreed by a committee, and you have to have a majority. Anything that is new... it's difficult to get. This is why I've been lucky with Dossier and then Barato, because I had no committee. They decided, we go, we went.
That's
no
beauty.
Peer review.
Yeah.
A lesson to keep, okay?
Yeah.
When you want to do something really new, and I can tell you the criticism at that time were terrible. What? Do you want to do this stupid thing? There is no science behind that. This is true, actually.
Yeah.
But say, we need it. We need it. If we want to make new hypotheses, we need that. Okay? But without this freedom, these things would have never happened, and I think the genome story will be still ongoing because of that. So when I start to propose my new ideas on how to use genetics to improve medicine, it was rejected by the community also, the same story. I wanted to make the SNP map, therefore, World Genome Association study, okay, that I did. I could not do it, so I quit, and I went to Genset to do that. So we put the patent. The patent was granted on GWAS, okay, Genome-Wide Association Study, and I started to make the first GWAS at that time, tinkering, dealing with affymetric that was starting to...
Oh, right, yeah.
I'm
yeah.
very close to Steve Fuller. And then we did the first, more or less, map, and... as usual, at that time, I really wanted to be silent and not. I was for many reasons uncomfortable with hype on media, like I did before.
Yeah.
It was too much.
Oh, what do you mean?
When you are exposed like this into media, okay, you get sort of addicted, and you what you say is not really what you think, and sometimes you over anticipate things.
But you said, like you did before, you mean with the during the
Genetone period, because I was exposed to media because the money came from the telethon, so I have to report to media.
Right, right.
So it was a little painful to me. So I said, okay, let's work. No hype, silence, and do things. So we did the GWAS. I even did not publish it. Just but I did it.
You didn't publish it at all?
Never.
Right.
It was granted, so it was the real first thing. But
right.
I was not interested in this. I was not interested in communicating, frankly, just with the investors because I had to. So I did a lot of things that were not published. But I made the first scan, and I find out one thing that is very important is when you have many SNPs, millions, hundreds, thousands, you have the so-called multiple testing story. What is this? If you test 1 million tests, 5% by chance would be positive at 5% p-value.
Uh-huh.
It's called multiple testing, very well known. So we knew from dose time, from HLA, that the correction is called Bonferroni, it's a correction. You divide the p-value 5% by the number of tests. And I did that, and I realized that you miss 90%. You take the very top association, and you miss the middle one that are probably as important. So I say, okay, this correction will create a problem. So we have to think how to find all associated genes, not the one that are the best associated. That was my first experience because I did it the first, but nobody knows that.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Never published it. So the idea came later. How?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
What do we do to escape to this multiple test issue? And blah, 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 I made the story short. And at the same time, I was in Genset discussing with a lot of companies, like in Millennium, and I saw during these 15 years, the pipeline of companies declined. Less and less and less new drug approved.
Right.
The only one that were approved were Me Too's one,
yeah.
For example.
Yeah.
And I say, guys, we have done this genomic story to change medicine, then the reverse. We have less drugs than before. What is the issue?
That's a great question. Let's talk about that, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So there's two. So you're part of two companies, yeah. Millennium and yeah. Genset, yeah. who were founded on genomics with yeah. the idea that this discovering, you know, by mining the human genome, as they say, you would find new druggable targets. Yeah. We'd eventually get drugs out of it. Millennium did get a drug approved. You know, they got Velcade approved.
It was not done at Millennium.
It wasn't theirs, right? They bought that in. Yeah. It came from Leukocyte, Proscript, I think, before that. Genset did not get a drug approved either.
None of the, all of these companies.
Right. So us. What's the problem?
What do you mean? When you say they have not found, they developed drugs, but they didn't work.
Exactly.
That's right. Different.
Right.
Okay. So now let's ask the question. Why?
Right. So then we have these companies that were doing things like, here's the gene that is associated with disease X. We're going to fix that gene and fix the disease. And that is not the case, right? Because the biology behind it is
because
more complex.
It's not enough.
Yeah, it's not enough. Right.
It's not enough. So we say, okay, guys, let's put three targets, not two. That's the idea. And then I read again just what is known. Tuberculosis was fought by combination of drugs. AIDS, hypertension, cancer, everything successful. The only thing that was successful was combination. Only thing. And highly successful. And the most successful was three therapies for AIDS.
HIV, right. Yeah.
Miracle.
Yeah.
That in 10 years or so, we cured a disease that was a devastating issue. Okay. So I combine all of this. Okay, makes sense to combine drugs. And the point, we fail because we just use monotherapy. So we say monotherapy has reached its limits. Why it could work? We already have done it. What is to remain to be treated should be done by polytherapy. First idea. Second idea. Is never believe in the miracle. The main problem of our field, because we talk with media, or I was exposed to this, or we talk with investors, is the miracle thing. The first mistake, the magic bullet, the single drug that will cure. That means you give a drug to an Alzheimer, and the day after is back to normal, and or the handicapped guy will walk. It has never happened, very few exceptions, like vaccine.
Right.
It does not happen. And if you look at in cancer, I was involved also in leukemia in children. When I started, at that time, 95% of the kids die. Now the reverse. 95% of these kids survive. Yeah. Have you seen any miracle? Have you heard any? Any news? Yeah, we change. This has happened every year, 1% better. And you say that. This is to conclude the vision that came with my team. We should combine drugs, but don't expect a miracle. You will see it will be better than single drugs, but the increment will be minimal. And then we'll improve this cocktail, like we did in cancer.
Right.
That's what we have. So that's what's the idea. So then we say, okay. That if we suppose that we know how to make inventory of targets because we need to have, but if I have to design it, if I take an unmet need, a disease without any ongoing drugs, like it was for AIDS, we have already secret drugs acting. You just have to combine these drugs together. It was easy in a way. Here I take a disease like Alzheimer's or Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, a neurological disease, no drug. So what I will mix? I will mix new drugs. I will design that could do that, but take times. And then when you combine drugs, the trend is to say it's rather dangerous because you can have interaction.
Uh-huh.
So mixing new drugs is a big risk.
This sounds like Pharnext.
Yes.
Yeah, that's where we're going. Okay, keep going. Keep going. So wait.
We're getting.
You're still, this. When you're thinking along these lines, it's not a Genset, or it is a Genset?
It was a Genset.
No.
It was a Genset, but we were not ready to do that. And actually, at that time, we were also acquired by Serono.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It was not clear. To use combination at that time was a nightmare in their mind. IP will never work. Many reasons. FDA will never like it. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. People were opposed to that.
Genset's acquired by Serono, and then you're working in Serono at Genset.
Yes, I was working at Genset within Serono, and this is where I learned even more about how a big company works, what is the drug development. I learned a lot.
And you're still going once a week to
Millennium. At that time, I quit Millennium maybe 2 years after the start.
Oh, okay.
And to join Genset full time.
I see. Okay, I didn't know that. All right.
Good point. So I was in France full time. And then the idea of mixing all drugs, at that time we said, okay, we should reuse drugs. Instead take new drugs, to make new drugs, let's use the existing drugs. And this was very important also coming from our background on genome. The most important property in nature is pleiotropy. What's pleiotropy? Any molecule can be involved in many different functions, and sometimes the relationship between these functions is not that obvious.
Yep.
Pleiotropy. Mm-hmm. And why there is pleiotropy? This is very simple-minded idea from nature. Okay, nature. You remember when we discovered there are only 20,000 genes? It was a surprise.
Yeah.
Oh, only 20,000. When you thought endothelin, even endothelin is not big.
Yep.
Because we have billions of functions. How the nature did? Each time that a new function appeared during evolution, it has not added new proteins, not new genes. No, it just has made new assembling.
Uh-huh.
New sets. You see the reason?
I do, yeah.
New sets. Okay. New set of all things. Take all genes or whatever, all proteins, and you put them together in a new environment, and suddenly a new function appears.
And this was 2007. This is what you based Pharnext on. Yeah.
2007. Yeah. We picked two unmet needs to start. Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, that is a single gene defect. But frankly, the single gene defect is gene duplication doesn't mean that there are not other genes involved. The variability in between patients with the same mutation is extremely large. I mean, many genes involved. So it's still multifactorial.
Uh-huh.
Whatever.
Yeah.
So we picked an Alzheimer because Alzheimer is Alzheimer's. And we picked two models. Believe me that one could be simpler than the other, but it's not really true. We made this network for each, a year of work each. We predicted targets. We predicted drugs. And the idea, so how do we know that this network is true? First of all, we don't believe it is 100% true. It has a lot of, probably some mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So say, don't spend time to validate this network experimentally by doing this differential. You lose your time. You want to see if the drug you predict are pertinent to the disease.
Right.
And make the story short, when we take the drug we predict from these networks and screen them one by one on many assays, not one, but many assays, 50 to 75% of them are positive. If the network, that's enough for me.
Yeah.
If the
network
was bad, I will not get this result, but I have 50%. I mean, something like 25 to 30 drugs that I've been able to reposition.
Yeah, I took you. You have one in phase three now, right?
And
for
now,
CNT.
of these, we make different combination, and one combination of three is now in phase three for CMT, and one combination of two in phase two for Alzheimer's. And you just got the results; it seems positive. So we continue, but the idea is that so far so good. Yeah.
You're mining the genome, making drugs.
To make drugs, but combination, low-dose, repurposed, and so on. I mean, the new type, the new profile of treatment that I believe will not change dramatically, as I told you. It will not be a miracle drug, but it will be better drug than what is previously.
Yeah.
And that will improve it with time. We'll improve the dosage, we'll add compounds, we'll do two, because we started with two, three, and then people say, are you crazy to mix three drugs? Suddenly last year, Rusty Katz from the FDA, just retired from the neurological section, say we should mix three, four, even more. He understood that just if you are too shy in mixing a thing, you'll never get it.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, we know single drugs don't work. Why we continue? That's the story of Rusty. So that's why. So little by little, we get convinced of that. We got result. We are now more convinced that the trend, the paradigm is good, and I'm purely convinced it's good. It will be successful. And I think that it is important to understand that with time, each cocktail will improve. And this is the way it could be in medicine today.
I wanted to ask you too, from my research here, your book, The Genes of Hope. Why did you write it? What led you to write it?
This was also under pressure of the media, the telephone. I have to report. I wanted to show to the, because I made this map with the money of the public.
Yep.
Not public money, the money of donors, and some donors very poor. You should know that in Teleton, I saw people not making more than $200 a month, giving $2. So it's
What is Teleton?
Teleton is a fundraising you do on TV.
Right.
For one night, overnight, you have people, you show, you explain the disease, you show patient, and people are
So you did those, and people called in and donated.
Not me. French Muscular Association.
Yes, he held a Teleton for your company and raised money.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Not my company. For the maps.
For the maps.
For the maps. And therefore, I had to report, in a way,
yes.
what we have done, and tell all this story with Mitterrand, and in order to thank them of their contribution. That was my only goal. But the book, frankly, was not very good.
Wait. It's been translated into 7 languages, I saw, and it won the Grandmaster Prize for medical literature or something. Is that not good?
I think it was not very. It was too complicated. For me, maybe.
I wanted to read it, but I couldn't.
Therefore, you can find there that we anticipate what is going on now. So we say that many things were anticipated. The genome-wide association will come, will be important, and also sort of we predicted that the society will not resist to the idea of transhumanism. I mean, to transform the body. That building is not totally welcome today, but the opportunity will be, and people will dream having a new sort of human being, genes or automate to make. And this is going on now. With a certain chance of success, we will see. But I'm not a fan of this.
It's a fan of what?
Of transhumanism. I think we are not very ready. It's very expensive.
What are we talking about? Do
you know what's transhumanism? Is the willingness to make men assisted by technology.
Oh, of course. I'm sorry.
Brain assisted by computer, mechanics, artificial art.
You're not a fan of that. Like you're saying,
I am a fan. The plan, yeah.
If no, someone loses an
fine,
arm,
that's
no.
Fine, that's
you mean
fine.
Like getting a computer chip in your brain?
Yeah. The point is, I'm sure we need to evolve and to be much smarter than we are, because we have to leave this planet, not because of. Of the climate, because we will disappear in 3 billion years.
Yeah.
So that's, at any moment we have to leave.
Yeah.
And we are certainly not ready for that, because there are many technical. So we have to do that, just on a philosophical level. And I say in this book, because of that, we will need to push ourselves. But I think before we go to help your brain, our brain, by technology, we should more explore how to better exploit our brain. Because if we assist the brain by instrument, the brain de-evolves. We need to evolve more.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, that actually makes the brain work less hard.
Yeah.
You're saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's then.
You know that is. Yeah. You know, people say this. You know, we all carry phones around now, and anytime you need to remember something, you just look it up on your phone. So your brain actually doesn't work
that's
as hard
example.
As it used to be. Yeah, that's interesting.
Although we can find advantage to this, but I think we have also to follow the wonderful capacity of brain that you can see in. Some disease, actually, you see that math could be great, memory could be great. So why, if you could help that, having these properties without being autistic or so, it will be, but there is still some secrecy we would like to better understand in the brain before we stop this.
Yeah.
That's my impression.
So you don't have another book in you, is what you're saying? You're not.
I'm trying to prepare a book now.
Oh, you are?
On all this story, yes.
Do you just want to, just shortly what it is? What's it about?
It's called multiversal thinking. I'm very intrigued by this story of multiverse. And actually, when I talk about disease and pyrotherapy, it's
all tied
in. Our enemies won. The world won is our enemy. We have to think never won. So I contested the word universe, and I just Googled and I found multiverse.
You use that
people,
word said.
People are using it.
Yeah.
We think they are crazy, but they're not that stupid.
Yeah, no. I've heard it before.
Yeah. And it makes sense. And actually, this is by discussing with my son, the idea comes. My son is a young pianist, 10 years. And we discuss about the... So he's a sort of illuminated guy, a cosmic guy. You know. I always speak about death, life, and the universe. And is the universe finite or infinite? I said, what do you think? Is finite or infinite?
How old is he?
He's 11.
11? He's asking about 10. If the universe is infinite or not?
Yeah, so, you know, many kids, the, many kids think this. He's not, me, I was the same, probably you.
Yeah.
And
curious.
He told me, okay, infinite, I can't. It's difficult for me. Finite is even more complex. For me, to tell me that the world finished and after that,
right.
I don't...
That's exactly right.
The two are difficult. So he told me, Dad, don't worry, it's both. He accepted that the one, the or is not good. One, these are the and.
Yep.
The world is finite and infinite. So this guy is crazy, definitely. Keep playing piano, that's good. And I Googled. And I found a theory that just came out a year or 2 years when they say, yes, the universe is both finite and infinite. It means that if you send a stone...
It'll go forever.
It will go forever, but it'll come back,
it'll come back
to your neck.
Yeah.
That's exactly. So
your son was right.
He was right. Because he's a child.
For him,
there is no limit and no barrier.
Let me ask you a few things about that. One is we haven't talked about, you know, you just mentioned your son. You're married. You have kids.
Yes.
When did
five
that happen?
Kids.
Five kids. When did that happen?
A little by little.
not all at once?
That happened. I have a kid from 30 to 10.
Okay. So your oldest is 30?
Oldest is 30.
Yeah. Oh.
He managed informatic company. And oldest is 50. He's 10. He's a pianist.
He's the pianist, yeah. So speaking about genetics, what do you think that you've passed down to them?
I think this is very interesting. I think certainly the culture of doubt.
The control of doubt.
The culture.
Oh, the culture of doubt.
Doubt. A-M-N-A. This is why my son... And all my other children are like this.
You know, the concept of constantly questioning, you mean?
Yes. Doubt. Don't take it. Don't take anything for granted. What you hear, just question. That story and tolerance is to accept that there are many truths, many different truths. The same concept. Tolerance is based on doubt. And I think they got that. They're all... The five are musicians also.
They are?
Yeah.
So they got that from you?
Yeah. I teach them all music. Even my son, the last one, I teach him piano every day, 1 to 2 hours, every day.
Do you conduct him?
He knows how to conduct.
He does?
Yes.
Huh.
He conducted when he was six, a big orchestra, he's doing well.
It's amazing.
So that's, I don't know if it's probably part is genetics, the other part is environmental. But
is your wife musical?
My wife is not.
Hmm. So maybe they got it from you. Yeah.
Whatever.
But you mentioned earlier that, you know, because you were born in Tunisia, that you saw a lot of different cultures living, you know, side by side, and that sort of informed your brain as a way to look at problems. So that would seem more nature than nurture,
sure
I mean.
I'm sure it's nurture. But, you know, there's sort of imprinting of... It's the difficult story. It's both. It's not and or.
Yeah, exactly. we just did it, right?
Yeah. I must have... My father was... he's still alive. So very smart. Very, very smart with no education.
What did he do?
He was a trader in dates.
Oh,
fruit.
Yeah, okay. He's
Tunisia.
Commerce. Yeah.
And a tool trader, a commercial guy. But extremely smart and also... You never know when you transmit something if it's by culture or by genes. Never. It's difficult.
Yeah, did he teach you to be that way or did it come in your brain?
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Right.
Certainly. And also for the music, finally, he was not educated in music, but his song was perfectly well-tuned, for example. He sings very well-tuned. I don't know if it's, we'll never know where our genes, where our nurture.
I mean, but so looking at the difference between your father and you, it seems like the difference is opportunity, right? You had opportunity that he
did not. Yes, I had the chance to be exposed to the right environment at the right time.
And now your children too, which is
and
basically...
And the children too, absolutely.
As you mentioned, it's like evolving.
That's life, I
that's
think.
Life. Yeah. That's the immigrant's life, for sure.
Yeah. The problem is to be able to listen to your own internal voice and believe it. My first voice told me A and non-A should not be or. I think this has been the first thing I...
It's
the second thing I was trained is my first professor, first teacher in medicine. He was a French guy, very old French guy, very old fashioned, speaking only French. Uh-huh. And he told us, guys, remember this sentence. And to my big surprise, he writes a sentence in English.
What was it?
What could I know about it if I don't measure it?
What could I know about it if I don't measure it? Meaning you have to measure everything. Yeah. It's data collection. Yeah, that worked for you too.
I was 22. And this has impressed me. The sentence, because he wrote it in English.
Yeah, it's stuck in your brain.
I read
an article, I think it was in Science, and it was an anonymous source in an article, it was a profile on you, and they said that, Daniel is not a classic scientist.
I don't want to belong to the community. I'm a sort of anarchist. So I don't like to publish. I don't like to give talk, really. I like music,
yeah,
and I like science, but for pleasure, and to make things happen. So it happened that in biotech it's much easier because you have to convince one or two investors and you are done, right? And there are billions of investors, so it's in a way easier. And I like this freedom you can get. It's a paradox. Listen to these young guys. You have more freedom in a biotech company because you have to convince only one or two guys. That's all. The one that will give you the money.
Yep.
And you do what you want. This is not the case in academia where you have to make your propaganda, your blah, blah, blah. To date, if I want to publish what I'm doing, it will be rejected. I tell you, I'm sure. It will be rejected because we are not going where the common sense, to the common today sense.
Yeah.
This is why I publish very little.
Plus, you don't like it.
I don't like. I'm lazy.
Yeah,
to be frank.
Not lazy. I don't think you could say you're lazy.
That's very important. I am lazy to write. I'm lazy to read.
Really?
And I think it has influenced me a lot in a good sense.
You mean read for pleasure or
no,
read
no, no,
the,
no,
the read, literature, read, the scientific read, literature?
I like to read novels or not that much, but I like. I spend so much time to listen music that I have little time to. Read, but scientific papers that I never read. Never.
Interesting.
Since the beginning. I just discussed with my colleagues and they told me this guy, blah, blah, blah. It has, I think, the consequence, I'm not influenced by the current thinking. So therefore, like, you know, Darwinism tell you to create a new species by isolation.
Yes. Yeah.
I think I went that way.
You think you went that way?
I'm a mutant in a way, a new species of scientist. This is why they say it's not classical.
Yeah, right. So you slightly mutate away from the rest of the scientists.
Yeah, because I'm isolated.
Do you look for new music? Are you listening to new
composers?
Absolutely.
I look for new composer. I'm not a fan of all of them. So I was a big hater of Boulez that just died. Because sometimes it does not eat, but some new composer are. Mancini are great guys, great, interesting to me, and I love to compose too when I have time. So I wrote many songs. Now I'm trying to work on a symphony, but this will take long.
Yeah, of course. You're working on a symphony.
Yeah, you need much more expertise. That's very difficult. But frankly, you have to know orchestra very well, each instrument very well. Composition is not that big deal. The problem is to know.
Do you listen to contemporary music at all?
I do everything, actually. Jazz.
Yeah.
I even earn some money by playing jazz in piano bar, weddings.
Yeah. You do that.
When I was a student. So I wrote songs that were even made by singers.
Oh, you wrote songs that other singers
one
did?
One was very bad because I had no time, but I did it because I enjoyed it. And
do I know it? I don't know the song.
No. See, nobody knows. It has. I think we sold it maybe 5,000 CDs. That was very, very bad. I know why. The song was great. The, for any reason, the company changed the harmony of the song.
Ah.
It was a disaster. That's what, but okay, whatever. So I'm very interested in this new sort of new creation. And I believe it belongs to my energy to think further in science. But I don't dissociate science or medicine from music.
No, you keep them together.
Or art. I love poetry, for example.
Well, okay. And this might be the last question, but because I've asked other people who have had near this sort of question. I mean, for me, it seems like both in art and in science, you know, the question is you need to be curious. You need to be curious about new things and pushing boundaries or whatever. Do you agree with that? I mean, you said
absolutely.
You've had a very curious mind.
You have to. You have to be curious. And, you know, the curious is the guy that says no. I say no, this is not usual. I want to know more.
Yeah, so you have to be curious and observant.
Yeah. No, this is not logical. Let's continue. This is a very complex property. Curiosity is sort of gift. I'm not sure everyone could be curious.
Are your kids curious?
Very curious.
Yeah, it might be genetics.
Never know, because you know I go out with them. I say, oh, look at this. Look at you. Never know at the end. It's a difficult story, but this is probably both, in my opinion. Because you can do twin study, you know about twin study, true twin and false twin. In general, anything you study, you have a contribution of genes.
Yep.
But not 100%. The problem is very rare when it's 100%, and people take the rarity as the rule. That, you see the point. You know, when Mendel described the gene,
yep.
It was rejected by the community. Why?
No one ever heard
of
it.
Yeah. That's very interesting. It was the story was forgotten because the anthropologist guy say it's not possible your story, because if it was you have one gene controlling this and one gene controlling this, anything should be white or black. You always have only tall people and small people.
Yeah.
And no, it's the distribution is like this sort of bell curve. So your story is that. Is wrong. And they were wrong and right at the same time, because monogenic is very rare, but polygenic will explain the bell curve.
You're right. Yeah.
So it's important to remember that Mendel was absolutely right and absolutely wrong, because he wanted to generalize that finding to anything, and the anthropologists were also wrong and right. And
thank you. Thank you for coming in. It's been fun.
Thank you so much.
There. Wasn't that fun? He was a great guy to talk to. So thank you, Daniel, for coming into our studio. Thanks to the Midwest Quiet, as always, for use of their music. If you are looking for more information on Daniel Cohen, go to our blog, Trade Secrets. You can find the blog off of the Nature Biotechnology homepage, or if you just put the words Trade Secrets and Nature into Google, it's the first result. I've gathered some information on Daniel, some background and his headshot, and put it there. Other than that, I have nothing to report. So until the next podcast, goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.